The nation prepares to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. A new justice report reveals a systematic attempt to deprive African Americans of their constitutional rights. Coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for March 5th, 2015, on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avaram, being joined shortly by Lucy Murphy.
Okay.
A big thanks to all those who supported WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital during our recent fund drive. And actually, you can keep giving and encourage your family and friends who understand the importance of independent media in the nation's capital in these times we live in. Well, a new horrific report by the Department of Justice about the illegal, brutal, and unconstitutional acts of the Ferguson Police Department is released as the nation is also commemorating the 50th anniversary of March 7th, 1965, known as Bloody Sunday, when hundreds of peaceful protesters were brutally beaten and tear-gassed by the Alabama State Police as part of a mass movement to secure voting rights for African Americans living under the terror of Jim Crow. We'll hear about the report from U.S. Attorney Eric Holder in his own words, and later in the show, Professor Gerald Horn will join us to discuss both the anniversary and the DOJ report, and of course, we'll take your calls at the bottom of the hour. As always, we have a jam-packed show, starting with our headlines.
A Justice Department probe has concluded Ferguson police and city courts engaged in a pattern and practice of discrimination against African American residents. A long-awaited report released yesterday finds police disproportionately stopped, arrested, and used force against blacks without reasonable suspicion. Despite comprising about 66% of the local population, African Americans accounted for 93% of arrests, 88% of incidents where force was used, 90% of citations, and 85% of traffic stops. Investigators also found rampant racism and cite at least two offensive emails. Ferguson may now enter into a consent decree and agree to police and court reform under the watch of federal monitors. In announcing the results of the report, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder said that Ferguson officials correct illegal practices.
It is time for Ferguson's leaders to take immediate, wholesale, and structural corrective action. Now, let me be very clear. The United States Department of Justice reserves all of its rights and abilities to force compliance and to implement basic change. Nothing is off the table.
The Ferguson report comes as a White House task force on policing has called for a series of reforms, including increased transparency and independent probes of fatal shootings.
The mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, has apologized after the city claimed in a legal document 12-year-old African-American Tamir Rice was to blame for his own death at the hands of police. Rice was playing with a toy gun when police fatally shot him within 2 seconds of their arrival. But in response to a lawsuit filed by Rice's family, the city claimed Tamir Rice's death was directly and proximately caused by his failure to exercise due care to avoid injury. Mayor Frank Jackson apologized on Tuesday.
We are apologizing today as a city to the family of Tamir Rice and to the citizens of the city of Cleveland for our poor use of words and our insensitivity in the use of those words.
The news comes as the Los Angeles Police Department is facing protests for its killing of a homeless man on Skid Row, and as the Mexican government has condemned the third U.S. police killing of a Mexican citizen in the past month. Police in Santa Ana, California killed Ernesto Javier Canepa Diaz during what they said was a robbery investigation, but few details have been released. Meanwhile, a White House task force on policing has called for a series of reforms, including increased transparency and independent probes of fatal shootings.
In Chicago, dozens of people have rallied outside a secretive police facility tied to the abuse and mistreatment of prisoners. The Guardian revealed recently that Chicago police have used a nondescript warehouse known as Homan Square to conduct detentions and interrogations. Prisoners were allegedly denied access to their attorneys, beaten, and held for up to 24 hours without any official record of their detention.
And the trial of the so-called Flood Wall Street 11 has opened in New York. On September 22nd, the day after the historic People's Climate March, thousands of people stage a mass sit-in in Manhattan's financial district to protest the role of big banks and the capitalist system in climate change. More than 100 people were arrested, and 11 of them have taken the charges to court. They plan to use the necessity defense to argue their actions were justified by the urgency of corporate-fueled climate change. Here in D.C. this week, demonstrators gathered on Capitol Hill to both support and oppose the speech by Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu before Congress, designed to scuttle negotiations about Iran's nuclear program.
Those who do not think that Black Lives Matter, Palestinian Lives Matter, Muslim Lives Matter, or any of the other communities matter, well, we're standing here to say that we do matter.
We think this speech is an outrage. 63% of the American people agree with us and think the speech should have been canceled. Iran is within the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. They have the right to develop nuclear power for civilian use, as does every other country on the planet. The IAEA inspects Iran more than any other country in the world. Israel, on the other hand, refuses to sign the treaty with the International Atomic Energy Agency because Israel, in fact, has nuclear weapons.
The last voice you heard was Brian Becker, National Coordinator of the Answer Coalition.
Looking to the West, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has compared militants from the self-proclaimed Islamic State to pro-union labor protesters in Wisconsin. Thousands of protesters have flooded the Capitol over an anti-union right-to-work bill passed by the state Senate this week. And looking south, Venezuela has ordered the Obama administration to reduce staff at its embassy in Caracas by 80% amidst the worst diplomatic spat since President Nicolas Maduro's election in 2013. Maduro has accused right-wing opponents of fomenting a coup with U.S. support. His government has given the United States 15 days to cut embassy staff from 100 to 17.
And finally, in our culture and media moment for Women's History Month, you know, I had to put this in because I was going to play this awesome speech I heard yesterday morning by the new NAACP president. Yes, and it was an awesome speech. But when I heard about this, I said, I had to put this in. We're going to put this in for Women's History Month. A new documentary about rape in India has just been banned by the country. Abby Zimmet, writing for CommonDreams.org, tells us that India's savage 2012 gang rape on a Delhi bus of a 23-year-old medical student who later died caused international outrage and a tightening of Indian anti-rape laws, including the death penalty for particularly egregious crimes. But societal change comes hard in an infamously unsafe country where a rape is still reported every 16 minutes, and where a new film in which one of the perpetrators blithely blames the victim for being out that night is causing furor. But little surprise. The brutal rape of medical student Jyoti Singh 2 years ago led to days of protests, passage of new sexual violence laws, and the eventual arrest of 5 suspects, all later convicted and sentenced to death. 4 are appealing, including the bus driver Mukesh Singh. the focus of the current uproar about the case centers on Singh, who was interviewed on death row for this documentary, India's Daughter. And this is a new documentary by award-winning British filmmaker Leslie Udwin, in which Singh shows what Udwin calls not a second of remorse, arguing that a girl is far more responsible for rape than a boy, and a decent girl won't roam around at 9 o'clock at night. The film reportedly brutally lays bare India's persistent misogyny and repression, and one reviewer deemed it marrow-chilling, with sections that verge on the unwatchable. Here's the trailer for India's Daughter.
Well, most of us heard about the case very soon after it happened on December 17th, the very next day. And almost immediately, the students of the Jawaharlal Nehru University, there is a very powerful student union there and student movement there. So student organizations and the union from there immediately came out on the streets to protest on the same day.
Happening to a young woman who represented a symbol of new aspiration, sent shockwaves through the society. In the last 15 to 20 years, the economy has changed a lot in India, and it's created opportunities for young women and single women to come and work. And it's raised expectations across a range of classes of young single women of how they should be allowed to live their lives.
There are many gang rapes that take place in India, and they've been taking place over the years. But somehow this caught the imagination of people. For one thing, it happened in the capital city. It happened in an evening hour, which was not a late hour, 8 o'clock, a young girl and boy returning home from a movie. I mean, it was the most normal kind of behavior.
Even though India's Daughter is banned in India, we found it on YouTube. Also, in response to India's rape crisis, there is Priya Shakti, a new comic book starring a rape survivor turned tiger rioting superhero. The comic book creator, Ram Devineni, hopes that superhero treatment will help shape not just legal but cultural change. Also, for Women's History Month, you are having an event this weekend.
Yes, I am, Lucy. So I want to invite listeners to the upcoming reception for my visual arts exhibit, Black to the Future, Meditations on Regeneration. It's going to be at the 410 Good Buddy Art Space at 410 Florida Avenue. And that's this Saturday, March 7th, from 6 to 9 p.m. Yeah, so there's kind of an evite on Facebook if people want to check that out at 410 Good Buddy Art Space. And then finally on International Women's Day, which is this Sunday, March 8th, Phyllis Bennis is hosting an event to honor Palestinian activist Rasmia Uday to help raise funds for her defense. Rasmia is currently facing deportation and 5 to 7 years in prison following her unjust conviction in November. But her struggle is far from over, as an appeals process will begin after sentencing on March 12th. So please join Phyllis Bennis and supporters on March 8th, that's this Sunday, from 4 to 8 p.m. at 1736 Columbia Road Northwest, number 409, and that's in Washington, D.C. And snacks and drinks will be served, and the Palestinian musician Fouad Foti will be performing. And so those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, the whole truth about what has been happening in Ferguson, the chilling report outlined by Eric Holder. Stay with us.
About the clothes you wear, I
Welcome back to On the Ground with Esther Iverum and Lucy Murphy. And you just heard Janelle Monae, Ghetto Woman. The Justice Department announced yesterday the findings of its two civil rights investigations related to Ferguson, Missouri. The Justice Department found that the Ferguson Police Department, FPD, engaged in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. The Justice Department also announced that the evidence examined in its independent federal investigation into the fatal shooting of Michael Brown does not support federal civil rights charges against Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. The details in this report are searing, and we want you to hear the extensive comments by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. We're going to hear his comments now, and afterward, we'll be speaking with Gerald Horn about the report on this run-up to the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which will be commemorated this Sunday in Selma, Alabama.
This investigation found a community that was deeply polarized, a community where deep distrust and hostility often characterized interactions between police and area residents, a community where local authorities consistently approached law enforcement not as a means for protecting public safety, but as a way to generate revenue, a community where both policing and municipal court practices were found to be disproportionately harmful to African-American residents, a community where this harm frequently appears to stem, at least in part, from racial bias, both implicit and explicit, and a community where all of these conditions, unlawful practices, and constitutional violations have not only severely undermined the public trust, eroded police legitimacy, and made local residents less safe, but created an intensely charged atmosphere where people feel under assault and under siege by those who are charged to serve and to protect them. Now, of course, violence is never justified. But seen in this context, amid a highly toxic environment, defined by mistrust and resentment, stoked by years of bad feelings, and spurred by illegal and misguided practices, it's not difficult to imagine how a single tragic incident set off the city of Ferguson like a powder keg. In a sense, members of the community may not have been responding only to a single isolated confrontation, but also to a pervasive, corrosive, and deeply unfortunate lack of trust, attributable to numerous constitutional violations by their law enforcement officials, including First Amendment abuses, unreasonable searches and seizures, and excessive and dangerous use of force, exacerbated by severely disproportionate use of these tactics against African Americans, and driven by overriding pressure from the city to use law enforcement not as a public service, but as a tool for raising revenue. Now, according to our investigation, this emphasis on revenue generation through policing has fostered unconstitutional practices or practices that contribute to constitutional violations at nearly every level of Ferguson's law enforcement system. Ferguson police officers issued nearly 50% more citations in the last year than they did in 2010, an increase that has not been driven or even accompanied by a rise in crime. As a result of this excessive reliance on ticketing, today the city generates a significant amount of revenue from the enforcement of code provisions. Along with taxes and other revenue streams in 2010, the city collected over $1.3 million in fines and fees collected by the court. For fiscal year 2015, Ferguson's city budget anticipates the revenues to exceed $3 million, more than double the total from just 5 years prior. Our review of the evidence and our conversations with police officers have shown that significant pressure is brought to bear on law enforcement personnel to deliver on these revenue increases. Once the system is primed for maximizing revenue, starting with fines and fine enforcement, the city relies on the police force to serve essentially as a collection agency for the municipal court, rather than as a law enforcement entity focused primarily on maintaining and promoting public safety. and a wide variety of tactics, including disciplinary measures, are used to ensure certain levels of ticketing by individual officers, regardless of public safety needs. Now, as a result, it has become commonplace in Ferguson for officers to charge multiple violations for the same conduct. Three or four charges for a single stop is considered fairly routine. Some officers even compete to see who can issue the largest number of citations during a single stop, a total that in at least one instance rose as high as 14. And we have observed that even minor code violations can sometimes result in multiple arrests, jail time, and payments that exceed the cost of the original ticket many times over. Now, for example, in 2007, one woman received two parking tickets that together totaled $152. To date, she has paid $550 in fines and fees to the city of Ferguson. She has been arrested twice for having unpaid tickets, and she has spent 6 days in jail. Yet today, she still inexplicably owes Ferguson $541. And her story is only one of dozens of similar accounts that our investigation uncovered. Over time, it's clear that this culture of enforcement actions being disconnected from the public safety needs of the community, and often to the detriment of community residents, has given rise to a disturbing and unconstitutional pattern or practice. Our investigation showed that Ferguson police officers routinely violate the Fourth Amendment in stopping people without reasonable suspicion, arresting them without probable cause, and using unreasonable force against them. According to the police department's own records, its officers frequently infringe on residents' First Amendment rights. They interfere with the right to record police activities, and they make enforcement decisions based on the way individuals express themselves. Now, many of these constitutional violations have become routine. Now, for instance, even though it's illegal for police officers to detain a person, even briefly, without a reasonable suspicion, it's become common practice for officers in Ferguson to stop pedestrians and to request identification for no reason at all. And even in cases where police encounters start off as constitutionally defensible, we found that they frequently and rapidly escalate and end up blatantly and unnecessarily crossing the line. During the summer of 2012, one Ferguson police officer detained a 32-year-old African-American man who had just finished playing basketball at a park. The officer approached the man while he was sitting in his car and he was resting. The car's windows appeared to be more heavily tinted than Ferguson's code allowed, so the officer did have legitimate grounds to question him. But with no apparent justification, the officer proceeded to accuse the man of being a pedophile. He prohibited the man from using his cell phone and ordered him to get out of his car for a pat-down search, even though he had no reason to suspect that the man was armed. And when the man objected, citing his constitutional rights, the police officer drew his service weapon, pointed it at the man's head, and arrested him on 8 different counts. Now, this arrest caused the man to lose his job. Unfortunately, this event appears to have been anything but an isolated incident. Our investigation showed that members of Ferguson's police force frequently escalate rather than diffuse tensions with the residents that they encounter. And such actions are sometimes accompanied by First Amendment violations, including arresting people for talking back to officers, for recording their public activities, or engaging in other conduct that is constitutionally protected. This behavior not only exacerbates tensions in its own right, it has the effect of stifling community confidence that is absolutely vital for effective policing. And this, in turn, deepens the widespread distrust provoked by the department's other unconstitutional exercises of police power, none of which is more harmful than its pattern of excessive force. Now, among the incidents of excessive force discovered by our comprehensive review, some resulted from stops or arrests that had no legal basis to begin with. Others were punitive or retaliatory in nature. The police department's routine use of tasers was found to be not merely unconstitutional, but abusive and dangerous. records showed a really disturbing history of using unnecessary force against people with mental illness. And our findings indicated that the overwhelming majority of force, almost 90%, is directed against African Americans. Now, this deeply alarming statistic points to one of the most pernicious aspects of the conduct that our investigation uncovered, that these policing practices disproportionately harm African American residents. In fact, our review of the evidence found no alternative explanation for the disproportionate impact on African American residents other than implicit and explicit racial bias. No other basis. Between October 2012 and October 2014, despite making up only 67% of the population, African Americans accounted for a little over 85% of all traffic stops by the Ferguson Police Department. African Americans were twice as likely as white residents to be searched during a routine traffic stop, even though they were 26% less likely to carry contraband. Between October 2012 and July 2014, 35 black individuals and 0 white individuals received 5 or more citations at the same time. During the same period, African Americans accounted for fully 85% of the total charges brought by the Ferguson Police Department. African Americans made up over 90% of those charged with a highly discretionary offense described as, and I quote, manner of walking along roadway, unquote. Manner of walking along roadway. And use of dogs by Ferguson police appears to have been exclusively reserved for African Americans. In every case in which Ferguson police records recorded the race of a person bit by a police dog, that person was African American. The evidence of racial bias comes not only from statistics, but also from remarks made by police, city, and court officials. A thorough examination of the records, including a large volume of work emails, shows a number of public servants expressing racist comments or gender discrimination, demonstrating grotesque views and images of African Americans in which they were seen as the other, called transient by public officials and characterized as lacking personal responsibility. Now, I want to emphasize that all of these examples, statistics, and conclusions are drawn directly from the exhaustive findings report that the Department of Justice has now released. Clearly, these findings and others included in the report demonstrate that although some community perception of Michael Brown's tragic death may not have been accurate, the widespread conditions that these perceptions were based upon and the climate that gave rise to them were all too real. Some of those protesters were right. This is a reality that our investigators repeatedly encountered in their interviews of police and city officials, their conversations with local residents, and their review of thousands of pages of records and documents. This evidence pointed to an unfortunate and unsustainable situation that has not only severely damaged relationships between law enforcement and members of the community, but made professional policing vastly more difficult. And, I think very significantly, unnecessarily placed officers at increased risk. And today, now that our investigation has reached its conclusion, it is time. It is time for Ferguson's leaders to take immediate, wholesale, and structural corrective action. Now, let me be very clear. The United States Department of Justice reserves all of its rights and abilities to force compliance and to implement basic change. Nothing is off the table. The report from the Justice Department presents 2 sets of immediate recommendations for the Ferguson Police Department and the Municipal Court. These recommendations include the implementation of a robust system of true community policing, increased tracking, review, and analysis of Ferguson Police Department stop, search, ticketing, and arrest practices, increased civilian involvement in police decision-making, and the development of mechanisms to effectively respond to allegations of officer misconduct. They also involve changes to the municipal court system, including modifications to bond amounts and detention procedures, an end to the use of arrest warrants as a means of collecting owed fines and fees, and compliance with basic due process requirements. Ensuring meaningful, sustainable, and verifiable reform will require that these and other measures be part of a court-enforceable remedial process that includes involvement from community stakeholders, as well as independent oversight in order to remedy the conduct that we have identified, to address the underlying culture that we have uncovered, and to restore and to rebuild the trust that has so badly been eroded.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard comments from U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. After this break, we'll be speaking with Gerald Horn and taking your calls about the report on Ferguson on this run-up to the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which will be commemorated this Sunday. It's actually being commemorated now, leading up to Sunday in Selma, Alabama. Of course, 202-588-0893 will be the number to call. What are your comments on the report on Ferguson from the Department of Justice and also on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday? Stay with us.
Sometimes you have to go inside and reflect. Be still, gentle character. Be sweet, be mindful, be kind. Gentle character, moving from control into acceptance. Be gentle,
That was Navash Adeyo with Iwapele on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avera.
And I'm Lucy Murphy.
And at the same time that we're discussing the disturbing report by the Department of Justice about the illegal, brutal, and unconstitutional acts of the Ferguson Police Department this week, this week and through this weekend is also commemorating the day, March 7th, 1965, known as Bloody Sunday, when hundreds of peaceful protesters were brutally beaten and tear gassed by Alabama State Police as part of a mass movement to secure voting rights for African Americans living under the terror of Jim Crow. Well, to help us merge these two eras and topics is Professor Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, author of more than two dozen books, and I think about to publish a new one, and we'll get to that during the discussion. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So thank you for joining us today. I wanted to start with, you know, on the one hand, we have this DOJ report, and on the other hand, we're commemorating Bloody Sunday. And I just wanted to kind of throw it out in general and get your thoughts about this moment and the juxtaposition of these two things.
Well, first of all, the DOJ report reminds those who might have forgotten that the kind of persecution that people of African descent are enduring in North America, in the United States right now, is quite astonishing and astounding. It's difficult to read that report without thinking about the outrages of apartheid South Africa at its zenith. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it should remind us that if we are to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves, we not only have to emulate those heroic protesters on the Edmund Pettus Bridge some half century ago, some 50-odd years ago, but we also have to go one better. That is to say, we really have to take this to the international community, because the correlation of forces in the United States right now, as you know quite well in Washington, tips so decisively to the right, not least amongst the Euro-American population, that we have to emulate those who came before the 20th century in particular and go to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva and take our complaint to capitals of foreign land.
Right. And, you know, I think that a lot of people working in social justice movements don't kind of make that leap. And I think a lot of people feel very hampered by the structures they're in, whether it's like the not-for-profit sector or whether they're trying to work through the electoral process. You know, from your experience, how do organizations, you know, make that leap from kind of just focusing domestically to appealing to the international community?
Well, first of all, this is already happening. You know that last fall there were black youth from Chicago,
yes,
who were protesting torture of black people in Chicago by the police department, who took their complaint directly to Geneva. We know that the parents of Michael Brown, the slain teenager from Ferguson, Missouri, accompanied that particular delegation. So to a degree, that's already happening. Certainly with the reparations movement, it's happening. I think that those in the nonprofit sector who might be constrained by their funders, which I know is a real matter and should not be dismissed easily, the least they can do is not try to discourage those who are moving in the international direction, not try to put obstacles in their path, rhetorical or otherwise, and certainly at least give them covert support if they cannot give them overt support.
Do you see that happening, that kind of interference?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I mean, I think one of the problems we face right now, and I think your grandchildren will comment upon this, assuming that climate change or killer robots does not overcome us all, is that many in our leadership, I think, feel threatened by new initiatives that they cannot pursue, such as going to the international community, because their hands are tied, they can't do it, and they assume that a new leadership will emerge with this new thrust. And so, therefore, they put rhetorical roadblocks in the path and all the rest. But obviously, we have to overcome.
Okay. So I want to remind our listeners that you're invited to join the discussion at 202-588-0893. This is the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition, where we focus on activists and activism. And you are certainly invited to join the discussion. So, Professor Horn, the level of repression reported in the DOJ report was really shocking to me. I mean, I think when I emailed you about the show, I pointed out the line where there were charges about manner of walking along the roadway.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm from St. Louis, and I was just in St. Louis last week, and one of the things you notice when you drive around that neighborhood in what's called St. Louis County, there are oftentimes no sidewalks.
Exactly.
You have to walk in the road. And then when you walk on the road, that's considered to be an offense. I found it particularly shocking, this promiscuous use of police dogs biting black people,
right,
overwhelmingly and disproportionately black people, including 14-year-old youth. And then the business model of Ferguson, whereby they shake down the black citizens with regard to giving them tickets and then jailing them if they don't pay the tickets, and then the amount goes up. And then that's used to pay the salaries of city administrators. It's also striking that there are now reports that the Ferguson Police Department might have to go out of business, that they'll turn over their policing operations to St. Louis County because they will not be able to afford a fight, a legal fight against the Justice Department, nor will they be able to afford, it is reported, the kinds of reforms that would be necessary to satisfy the Department of Justice. I think that if they go out of business, that will be quite good news.
And I suppose that there's also the issue of these, you know, illegal practices being curtailed, kind of cutting into the income that is actually paying them. You know, when we, I think we have a couple callers, but we'll take a couple callers, and then I want to follow up on a discussion we were having last month on the F word segment. Just hold that in mind, and let's go to our first caller. Caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Okay, my name is Quentin. I'm calling from Southeast D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know that Dr. Horn is a lawyer also. And so ask Dr. Horn if he thought this might be the basis for a civil RICO action against the police department.
Hmm. You can ask him. He's listening to you.
He heard me.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling.
That's a very interesting question.
Racketeering.
RICO, as your listeners might know, is an unfortunate acronym in the sense that it has a sort of whiff of Italian-American bashing. But certainly, it's an interesting initiative that the caller raises, and certainly I think that public interest law firms, such as the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, should seriously consider taking Ferguson to court, and RICO might be a way, because we really have to punish these officials in Ferguson. It used to be said that you would beat one slave to keep the entire plantation in line.
Right.
But we have to give these officials in Ferguson a real beatdown
right.
so that other cities will not be inclined to follow their torturous path.
Right, because, you know, that same statute is used against people on the left who are trying to organize. You know, so, you know, it's a fascinating proposal or idea that he raises, and thank you, Quentin, for raising it. We're going to go to our next caller, and just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Tespa from Arlington. Good morning, Aster. Good morning, Dr. Horn.
Good morning.
You get taken seriously in two ways. One, you take your issue about your suffering seriously yourself. Second, if you are a suffering people and if there are other people just like you who are suffering just like you, you unite and become a force. People of African origin, whether they are in Africa, whether they are in America, whether they are in Australia or somewhere else, they are suffering. The only way we get taken is if we unite and take our issue seriously and take our issue to the right place. Going to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva is the right move. We all need to unite and be taken seriously and be taken as a force.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tespa. And let's go to one more caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is Mike. I'm calling from Washington, D.C., and I'd like to make two comments. One, I'd like to remind our listeners about Malcolm X's initiative in the early 60s to bring the United States before the United Nations and, again, the world tribunals regarding its history of oppression and racism towards African Americans. Also, I'd like Dr. Horn to discuss the discrepancy of the recent report from the Justice Department regarding Ferguson and the discrepancy between that and Michael Brown's civil rights, which were not considered to have been violated in that process.
Okay. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Professor Horn, do you want to take that caller?
Well, sure. Certainly, there's great disappointment at the fact that Officer Darren Wilson will not face federal indictment as a result of the slaying of Michael Brown. Of course, the Department of Justice would argue that the prosecutorial bar was so high that the way the Supreme Court has constructed the law, it makes it very difficult to prosecute police officers who kill innocent civilians like Michael Brown. Obviously, that calls for legislative remedies in Washington, that is to say, trying to change the law. Obviously, that's going to be very difficult given the Republican majority in both the House and the Senate, which, of course, argues even further for the caller's first point, which is going to the international arena, not only as Malcolm X suggested, but as Paul Robeson and William Patterson actually did in 1950, 1951, and many historians, including myself, have suggested that that helped to ignite the civil rights movement and helped to ignite Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which, of course, led to the agonized retreat of Jim Crow.
When the Michael Brown case, last year anyway, many legal experts predicted, you know, precisely what happened. They said that because of the legal standard that has been constructed by the Supreme Court, that it was very unlikely that Darren Wilson would face charges. And the way I understand it is that, you know, they've constructed the law in a way such that the prosecutor would have to prove intent, that Darren Wilson intended to, you know, shoot and kill Michael Brown before he, like, left his car. And, you know, some people would say that, well, I think that, you know, he did intend to if he left his car, because only one thing was going to happen if you continually shoot someone umpteen time. So is that correct, that, you know, the bar is set so that intent has to be proved?
Well, certainly the bar is rather high, and I don't know. I mean, I have to say that even though if the Department of Justice had brought a prosecution given the current standard, I'm sure that Eric Holder would have been dragged before a congressional committee once again and browbeaten by some Republicans in South Carolina. But I dare say that the prosecution, in my opinion, should have gone forward anyway, because prosecutions are deterrent. That is to say, even if the prosecutorial bar is high, if officers of the law that they're going to be dragged into court and they're going to have to drain their bank accounts to hire lawyers, or their union will have to drain its bank accounts to hire lawyers, I think that serves as an effective deterrent even if they are not successfully prosecuted. So given the fact that Holder's leaving office anyway, he'll be ensconced quite shortly in a affluent Washington, D.C. law firm, I think he should have brought the prosecution in any case.
Right. That's an excellent point. You know, kind of leave it there and see what happens. Okay, so I think we still have a few more. We have more callers, so let's go to the lines. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Jan X. I'm calling from Virginia. I just have a quick comment. With all due respect to Mr. Holder's findings, if you have a rabid dog, we all know that professional policing is not going to work.
Okay. Oh, okay. I think she's kind of backing up the point we're making. I guess, you know, if you have a rabid dog, professional policing is not going to work. Thank you for that comment. Let's go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Mary, Maryland.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, how's everybody going? I just say that we do have the power as people, and if black people really need to step up, and any other people who want to join the power. And one thing is, I never see what needs to happen. I'm really struck by the young lady that has a $500 ticket and is holding her up from going into the military. Mm-hmm. How come we haven't started a GoFundMe for the Ferguson people, you know, and some pro bono for lawyers to go down there and start assisting? It's because
there actually are legal funds. There actually are a lot of legal funds set up for the
But we need
and for bail money.
Because the walking gentleman has a $70,000 truck right now. We can get that young lady's ticket paid so she can go into the military. But like I said, we need to show our financial power. We already have showed our anger. I mean, like I said, shut Walmart down for one day. If we don't shop anywhere as black people for one day, we can put a dent in it. Second day, the stock market will start to show a reaction. The third day and so forth. We just have to do it.
Thank well, we you. Certainly did it on Black Friday, so we have to give ourselves credit for the things we have done.
I do give credit for what's going on now, but we know what we have to do. We have to start doing it now and
right.
every day.
Thank okay. You. All right. Well, we'll be right there with you, Mary. 202-588-0893. Do we have another caller, Luke? Oh, yes, okay. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Lisa from Baltimore.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi. On the international level, I've personally called embassies in D.C., the Indian embassy, Brazilian, et cetera, to ask them, their people, to divest from doing business with the United States. because of police brutality here and their crimes against humanity. And you can bet if they do it to us, they're going to do it to you. I mean, what nation of color hasn't the United States invaded, looted? I mean, it's, we're all connected.
Right.
And it, but unfortunately, it's not going to stop until Anglo males get some help. I'm not talking about all of them, but I'm talking about the ones who think they created this world and they can do to what whomever what they want to do. No, you cannot. This is our world, and it's time people stand up and check these people.
Okay,
I'm
Lisa.
Tired.
Thank you, and I think you were just about to, like, violate FCC rules, so thank you for your restraint in your language. So, Lisa brings up a good point. I wanted to mention that there is actually legislation pending in Annapolis, that will affect all of Maryland to basically, create more accountability for police in that state. And I don't have all the details right now, but I do want to connect with that coalition that is, in Annapolis. I think they're having a press conference this week, if they haven't had it, you know, already. And there's legislation that we definitely need to talk about here on WPFW that a broad coalition is supporting to hold police accountable. There are terrible police brutality situations in Baltimore. And we had the reporter from the Baltimore Sun, I think Mark Puente, last year, and we'll have to have him back again because his series helped spur that legislation. Gerald, we're running out of time, but I wanted to know if you had any final thoughts before we wrap up.
Well, first of all, with regard to that Maryland legislation, I would hope that those who plan to replace Senator Barbara Mikulski would go on record with regard to that piece of local state legislation. Secondly, with regard to the international thrust, the president of Zimbabwe is now the head of the African Union. He's also the head of the Southern African Development Community, the most powerful bloc on the continent. And as you well know, the United States has just extended sanctions against Zimbabwe. So I think that the Zimbabwe ambassador in Washington or the representative of the United Nations would be more than willing to entertain our complaints. Why this is not being pursued continues to confound me.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Professor Gerald Horn of University of Houston, Professor of History, African American Studies, a frequent commentator across the Pacifica Network, and our favorite geopolitical analyst for sure. You have a new book coming out soon, right? That is it on Haiti?
Yeah, it'll be up by the end of the year, or maybe in a few months. It's on the book's title is Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States Haitian Revolution, the Origins of the Dominican Republic. And it's really on how slavery retreated in the United States, which has a lot to do with the Haitian Revolution.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. But we'll keep talking to you about all the other books that you've written. Of course, your most recent books that we've discussed a lot. And we'll have to have you here in D.C. soon. I want to alert all listeners that we are definitely going to bring Gerald Horn here to D.C. soon, that WPFW on the ground will bring him here, and we'll have a great evening and support WPFW and Pacifica Radio in the process. So thank you, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. And so that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam.
And I'm Lucy Murphy.
Special thanks again to Gerald Horn for joining us today. And thanks to our engineer, Luke Stewart. Luke Stewart's in the house. Woo-ho! And thank you so much for listening and calling in. Thanks all our callers. So smart. I have the smartest listeners in the world, right?
Remember International Women's Day this weekend.
That's right. That's right. Go out and commemorate and celebrate. You know, we are women. Yeah. And you can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook pages and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Okay, stay tuned for Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Another woman coming to the board. All right. And so take care. Peace. Stay warm. Stay dry. Peace.